This program is produced by Visigoth Incorporated. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without the express consent of Visigoth Incorporated is strictly encouraged. I'm Phil McCracken, the voice behind the voice, and thank you for listening.
All right, now, of course, I completely blew the script and did not intro with the intro question, which now I have forgotten. So would you help me out there if you can?
Okay, well, I think the intro is, you know, it was, is it a question of a dialectic between 1984 and Brave New World?
Okay.
You know, either one's good and one's bad. I don't think you can look at them that way.
Okay.
Or Huxley, Orwell, good, bad. I don't think we can look at them that way. I think both of them have pieces of the puzzle. And if you look at both books, you see the extremes on either end on what the oligarchs, what the people in power of this world will do to retain and get power. And they'll do it any way they can. They'll go either Orwell's way or Huxley's way, and when necessary. And the speculation I have and that I've been thinking about is, I think at first there's a little more of Orwell than Huxley, but then again, can you establish a dictatorship going strictly Huxley's way? I don't know. I look around the world today and I see more Huxley than Orwell, at least in the United States. Maybe if I lived in Iran, I'd see more Orwell than Huxley. So, but I think both tactics will be used to establish what's coming. And it's not a dialectic. It's both of them you have to look at both of them and see what they're both saying, because either technique can come out in a minute.
All right, well, we're agreed that if it were to be a deliberate, quote, Hegelian dialectic, that they would both be in league, and they'd be working, each would be working their side of the street. That was not the case, I don't think.
I don't think so either,
No.
You know, Huxley had no respect for Hegel. I was listening on my way home from work, I was listening to an interview with Huxley, and one thing he said about, he was talking about William James was taking nitrous oxide back in the old days, and also how he also attempted to try peyote back in the early 20th century, and his stomach couldn't stand it, and he vomited it all up, and Huxley said that if James hadn't vomited up the peyote, they might have started research on psychedelic drugs 50 years earlier.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. he also said William James, and then he also mentioned it as an aside, that William James stated that he needed nitrous oxide to get anything at all out of Hegel. So I thought, just to bring Hegel in for a moment.
Literally, no.
And also, I have on my blog a little article that I found about Jeremy Bentham, the British philosopher, and Huxley basically was stating how Bentham, although he didn't try to be as deep, he's provided more practical benefit to man than Hegel ever could. Hegel, with all of his attempts at being deep and philosophical, has caused more mischief and war and trouble than Bentham, who just was cared about getting public services for the people and, you know, water mm-hmm. and sanitation and things like that.
That was an interesting period in time also, and not that far, if at all, perhaps right around the core of the turn of the century. And I'll tell you, I remember one of my last classes, I went back for a second degree in the mid-90s. I took British Lit, and, I mean, you get thrown in there also William and Henry James, and you get who's my buddy who did Portrait of an Artist?
That was one of the James.
But they were influenced on James. I can't believe I'm doing this. Oh, this is going to be sacrilege.
I never read that book. But
oh, God. I mean, I should stop the tape.
Oh, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man.
Yeah.
That was, he wrote Ulysses.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, this is
James,
horrible. Put the Jeopardy music on. What?
James Joyce.
Yes, James Joyce. And also, he couldn't stand William B. Yeats, and I thought that was great.
Well, Crowley hated Yeats, too.
Well, yeah. What was interesting was when I had that class and I had to do something on Yeats, Yeats called for a, he called it a Celtic twilight, and Joyce said, it's a Celtic toilet. And also, apparently, Crowley, as much as he had the mojo, supposedly was in fear of Yeats, which tells you where Yeats was at, on a scale of 1 to 10 with magicians, if you will.
Yeah, Yeats had some knowledge. They say there was a magical war between the two at some point.
I have to admit, Yeats's Desertion of the Circus Animals to me was one of the greatest works I ever read. And also, I'm digressing. But anyway, thanks for putting the James Joyce in there because, you know, obviously I had a brain fart and you helped me out with that. So we have agreed that, no, we don't think that this was a Hegelian dialectic, that Orwell was not.
No, I don't think they were work. I don't think that they were working both sides of the crowd. I think both of them were honestly trying to warn us about what they felt would happen or could happen. And I think Orwell was saying, "Look, it's not just happening. Could happen in Germany or Russia, but it could happen right here in England." And that's why he set 1984 in England. And Huxley was saying, looking at a further on down the line, he was saying the whole world could, when the whole world turns into one system, they'll do it this way. You know, they will not use the terror so much, but they'll use the mind control, they'll use the programming of the children, they'll use genetic manipulation to make sure everybody is fit and happy in the job they're in, and they'll use drugs to make sure they stay that way.
I don't know that this is germane, but this has come up with a little dialogue I'm having in emails. And that is, there's so much talk about being hit over the head and being forced to do things at the end of a bayonet. I guess perhaps what we're supposedly supposed to watch that's going on in Iran. But I think you can get most of the masses to go the way you want them to if you put them in privation. Now, the reason I'm saying this is that I don't even know if there's a continuum where Orwell's world would have come in after what Huxley envisioned or vice versa. But there seems to me to be a time when people are expecting guns and tanks and stuff, and I don't necessarily know that has to be the case, especially in the world they envisioned, or whether we're going to see it happen because of people being coerced by the need for necessities. Now, does that make any sense? I mean,
it makes a lot of sense, Keith. You know, I know you've had a little hair across your behind about Alex Jones, and he keeps warning of the bayonet type thing. You know, yeah. They're going to martial law, they're going to herd us into prison camps. But I really don't think that's the way it's going about. And if you look around right now, most people are happy in their servitude. I think I mentioned last time that with what's going on today in this country, the way the banks have basically done a coup d'etat on the government and they're running it, no one seems to care. You know, the criminals that should be in jail are running free and they're in the government. You know, the people, their enforcers are there. They've taken over the system. You know, these banks that have corrupted and bankrupted the United States now have their former leaders sitting in Treasury and sitting as advisors to the White House, and nobody is up in arms about it. Nobody seems to care. Everybody seems to be a little numb to it all.
Yes.
And so I have to say, I think Huxley's Brave New World is happening. You know, nobody's questioning. People are just happy to have a job. They're happy if they can bring home a paycheck and pay the bills.
Let me ask you this. Do you believe that the world that Huxley engendered in Brave New World, okay, and again, you need not know this, but I'm going to throw it out to you, was one that might have been in place after we had, if you believe we're going to have one, or even if it's written about in fiction, a WW3. Could this be something that's after the blast?
It's going to be that Brave New World system would come in via crisis somehow. Now, I have a great quote that from Brave New World Revisited by Huxley, and he says, "But liberty, as we all know, cannot flourish in a country that is permanently on a war footing, or even near war footing. Permanent crisis justifies permanent control of everybody and everything by the agencies of the central government. And permanent crisis is what we have to expect in a world in which overpopulation is producing a state of things in which communist auspices become almost inevitable. Now, that's a little dated,
right,
what he's saying.
Yeah.
But the idea, the gist of it, is perfectly reasonable if you look at what's going on now. You know, permanent crisis is what this country's been in since I think we've been born. It's always been something. You know, they can't just, you know, go on and just be a country. We always have something to worry about. There are always politicians railing about this or that problem, war in this idea, a war in this not living thing, or war in a concept, or war, or a country's going to destroy us. You know, like it turned out to be a straw man country like Russia that just fell apart because they couldn't keep it up. And you know, I think we're at the point now where we can't keep it up.
But let me ask you this. What you just mentioned was something that reminds me, again, I feel that in the United States and probably every nation, but of course we're propagandized to believe it can't happen here and it doesn't happen here and it won't happen here, and that is far left and far right bring you back deliberately to a certain point. And where I'm going with that is that what we're into, we never ever seem to relate to what Trotsky said about perpetual war for perpetual peace, and I think Orwell also had that. But I mean, but that's what we're into, and somehow we say it's okay because it's, you know, because we're the deliverers of liberty, and of course some people say that, yeah, that's what all the conquerors say, but that we're in that situation.
Pax Romana.
Yeah. No, and I mean, we make fun of this, but I think we embarked on this course at the behest of the old world powers. In back of Teddy Roosevelt after the Spanish-American War, in which he took part, and the fact that we had to flex our muscles with the Navy going around the world and all this other stuff, you know, and of course, you're right. In the 20th century, John, I mean, we've not ever been at war with anyone. I mean, they don't get into the history textbooks necessarily, but Butler fills us in, if you will, Smedley Butler.
Sure.
I mean, the gaps between the Spanish-American War, World War I, between World War I and World War II, after that and beyond, we've never not been fighting somewhere, and it can't always be because we're the exporters of liberty.
Well, it's the permanent war footing. We're not, you know,
yes.
And that's it. Basically, what we're doing, what the government has become, is the security services for the corporate entities that control it.
Yep.
Now, some people say they hate big government, and so do I, but the fact is, any huge entity that you have no control over, such as the huge corporations, are just as dangerous, if not more so, than big government. At least government, you do have some kind of a vote. I don't know what good it is. But you have no control over a corporation, especially corporations that control the government. And these corporations aren't patriotic things. They're out for themselves. They're out for the people that run them. And they're out for their own self-interest. You know, I still fail to see any reason why we're in Afghanistan and increasing our forces there, except because of the energy. And as we enter a world with less and less resources, whether mineral resources, energy resources, food resources, we are going to see more and more war. I mean, we're not going to all sit down at the table and agree on who gets how much of what.
Well, I'd wondered just a couple of minutes ago whether or not Huxley wrote from a point of view of after the Third World War.
He did indicate that there were upheavals. He doesn't get into it too much. I can't remember the details, but you know, when that the Age of Ford came in, it seemed like there was some revolts or revolutions and things, and then the Brave New World system became established. And he doesn't get into too much, but any new system isn't born bloodlessly. Usually something happened, and he doesn't really explain what it was.
Yeah.
You know, he just says that it happened, and I think there's some there's a passage in the book where there hasn't been any violence since the whatever, since some revolt that established the government originally.
I mean, Orwell talked about the group hate and having these vague notions of three major power blocks that were always at war with one another, although nobody really knew. They just were told about this via, the big screen and the group hate. And that's another thing I think that's very real. So, I'm walking through, a dark hallway trying to figure out where I am with regard to who did what when with discussing both Orwell's and Huxley's work. But I think, like I said, I think both at times now, whether he, John, we talked about this and some people emailed and said, Huxley's an unlikable character. And we addressed that.
We did, and he is. He comes from an upper middle class, well educated English family, well known intellectuals, and he was probably the prime intellectual of the late, the first half of the 20th century. And he's not an easy guy to feel warm to. He speaks almost as if he were, I hate to say it, but a god. He makes these proclamations.
In a pious manner, yes.
And he knows his stuff, and he was, like I say, a very impressive man, a good-looking gentleman, well-spoken, and he impressed people wherever he went. And I'm sure he was used to being treated with some deference, and I think that that does affect your attitude a little bit. Like I said, I'd much rather have a beer with Orwell.
Yeah.
And maybe I'd rather drop acid with Aldous. I don't know.
But no, I mean,
definitely be having more beers than I'd be seeing Orwell a lot more than I'd be seeing Aldous.
But that's not a flip remark, and I think actually that's pretty accurate. And anybody out there who's lived a little bit, the older the better, will actually understand completely what you said, and I do too. And let's not be phonies about this. We're not running for president. That's absolutely right. I probably would rather grab Orwell. I mean, he looked to me like a haggard English teacher. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And could get a,
well, I think Orwell would have better stories about his life, whereas Huxley could discuss art and literature a lot better than maybe Orwell could, maybe not. But if you wanted stories about something that they had done, definitely Orwell lived the life.
Yeah. Also, I think there was elitism that you won't deny, and the one thing we didn't talk about, and we don't have to now, if you want to make a comment, what was unsettling for me, and again, in a court of law, you could not attribute this to any kind of charge you wanted to level against Aldous Huxley, but here's his brother Julian being the first, what would you call it, president of UNESCO, which also is a group that's like not looking out for, it says it's looking out for our best interests, but I don't think it is. So you have that kind of that two-pronged thing going on with somewhat lording it over the world. Do you make a comment at all at this time about the relationship?
Maybe sometime we could go deeper into
without a doubt.
These matters, but Huxley had a break with not a break. I mean, they didn't have a feud or anything, but he did not agree with his brother Julian or or his former childhood friend J.B.S. Haldane about the what science could and couldn't do and what it could achieve and whether science would always bring benefits to the world. He also disagreed with Julian and Haldane on whether there was a spiritual component to the world. He sharply disagreed with the scientists who felt that it was just a material world, and if we learn to control it and we learn more science, we'll be able to fix all of our problems. And Huxley didn't go that way. He had other ideas.
All right. just before we go on with that, I just want to tell people, we're talking to John Bonanno. This is the second part of an interview that we're going to do. I guess it might run to part three. People seem to be intrigued by it, and I think rightly so, about Huxley, the real Huxley, the hidden Huxley, and also with regard to Orwell. Both of them came from the same area about the same time. And I've said to you all that I think that was an extremely interesting time in global history, what took place in London, in the city of London, at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. But be that as it may, John Bonanno is with us. Look, the site in which he posts, on which he posts articles, is johnnyb93.blogspot.com. But you can hit that, obviously, because the link is going to be there like it was with part one. And I don't know at this point whether it means anything or not, but John, have you got any kind of feedback back and forth where, you know, you find it edifying or whatever?
I haven't got lots of feedback, but what I've gotten has been positive. And I certainly welcome feedback, especially people who disagree. And like I said, if we're speaking as like gentlemen to each other, I'm welcome right. to take disagreement, and I can handle it. I can handle it, and I'll deal with it. And I'd love to answer any questions anyone wants to correspond. I welcome that. I welcome comments on the blog. I'm also an artist, and you can see some of my original work there, which I'm slowly posting a bit as I go along. And you can get an idea of what I do.
And I won't say more than this, but we want to congratulate you on being a new father-in-law.
That's true. And if you go to my blog, and you'll see some YouTube videos, and you can get to look at the bride and groom. There's the top video on there. Just give it a click, and you'll go to YouTube. And
I take it the weather cooperated somewhat?
You can see my lovely daughter.
Okay.
I call it gum-chewing bride and groom.
Okay. All right, back to unnecessary things. Going back to Huxley and Orwell. And again, as you said before, we should not necessarily look at this as a dichotomy, and I agree 100%. But the thing I also wanted to ask you about, and also because of the roots of this group, and he was part of this Bloomsbury group. Is that true?
That's true. He was associated. Now, I don't think you could say he was like one of the original members or one that stayed on all that long, but he was associated with most of them. He knew them all, and he was there. He socialized with them, and I think I did mention in the last time that his first novel, Chrome Yellow, lampooned them a bit, and it sort of got him on the outs with them.
Do you also know, I would assume, but that's not good enough, that he was part of the Fabian Socialists? Could we understand that he might have been in that circle?
I have not come across that. It's possible. I know that Huxley was not sympathetic to communism. I found several statements where he is down on communism. So socialism might be another matter. He did believe that his last book, Island, is if Brave New World was his dystopia, a cacatopia, Island is what he felt something we should be working for, and it's very idealistic, and a lot of hippies tried to live that way in the 60s, and it was difficult. Mm-hmm. But I haven't read the book in many years. I'd like to go back to it. I'm getting interested in it again, but at the end, they don't come to a good end, unfortunately. As many of the communes of the 60s didn't come to a good end.
Now, you see, I hesitate to want to ask you this question because I'll bring you down another road, but I'll try to make a side note on that. But what about the charge that, even though we'll take it that Huxley is not that likable or down-the-street kind of guy, and so we kind of look at him when he's up talking as like, who the hell are you? But what about the fact that, in essence, even though he might have somewhat railed against what might be happening or what he thought might happen, that in a sense he wanted that it should happen?
I think that's a little bit of a stretch.
Okay.
I've been reading a lot of Huxley lately for this, and especially his essays, and he is just not happy about the power structure that rules the world. I can show you a lot of quotes where he basically puts down the oligarchs, the rich, the powerful, that don't want the world to change, that want the world to stay, and they will do anything to keep it the way it is. So I think, you know, if you're looking for him, I don't think you can really say that he likes it, or is going for that. Let's see if I can find a quote quickly on that.
No problem.
Well, something like this. Why any quick-witted and sensitive person should feel ashamed of having said goodbye to politics, he couldn't imagine. This is from his novel, Time Must Have a Stop. The sordid intrigues behind the scenes, the conscious or unconscious hypocrisy of every form of effective public speaking, the asinine stupidity of that interminable repetition of the same absurd oversimplifications, the same illogical arguments and vulgar personalities, the same bad history and baseless prophecy. And that was supposed to be a man's highest duty. And if he chose instead the life of a civilized human being, he ought to be ashamed of himself. And was a character named Eustace Barnack, who some say reflected Huxley's own views. And there are many others where later on in life in his essays where he just blames the people in charge of the world. He says, you can't get rid of them. They're here. They hang on. They're the same ones in charge yesterday or in charge today. And you don't know who they are, for the most part. Maybe he did. I'm trying to find an even better quote that reflects that. I know I had one here. Let's see. No, it'll come to me. Maybe I'll come.
Yeah, no problem.
It as we speak, but you know, I had a really good one.
Well, I play the Jeopardy music, but I've.
I know. No, I hate to do. I hate to get hung up like that.
That's okay. Well, I get hung up all the time. Are you kidding me? No, we're not.
Like I said, my wife is thoroughly convinced I'm going demented. So.
Well, we had a discussion that in emails, and I think we both are, but that's okay. Because the good thing about it is, if you are going to dementia, you can't remember that you did it. So
that's exactly it.
Well, I told you that the really key for everybody out there, the key behavior is. Finding yourself out in the garage, knowing you went there for something and can't remember why.
That's true. Well, isn't the old joke, Alzheimer's is great, I make love to a different woman every night.
Every night, oh, geez. At least it's a woman, okay. but let's turn away before we go back to some other things that was on my mind. But and that was because everybody loves this, because this guy is probably greater than Elvis in legend, and that is Aleister Crowley, and whether or not he and Huxley had some time together.
Okay, last time we spoke, I stated I could find no evidence, just some assertions that had happened. So it was kind of playing at my mind, and now that's kind of, you know, I need to research that more. So I looked at my own bookshelf, and I found a biography of Crowley written by Richard Kaczynski. It was published, I think, in 2002. And I think I got 100 pages into it and stopped reading it. If I had kept reading up to page 359, I would have found this.
Okay.
And I'll just read the short passage here.
Sure.
Another notable contact at this time was with writer and critic Aldous Huxley. Although best known for Brave New World, his The Doors of Perception would serve almost as a manifesto for the psychedelic revolution of the 1960s. I'm not exactly sure of that because the way that revolution went off was not too much the way Huxley envisioned it. He was already an established writer when he and Crowley met. One can only imagine what they discussed, although on the heels of their meeting, Crowley wrote to Regardy. Now, Israel Regardy was Crowley's secretary for a short time until they had a falling out, which most people ended up having with Crowley. And here's the letter. Please send a copy of Clouds Without Water, which is a collection of Crowley's sonnets, to Aldous Huxley Esquire, Athenaeum Club, Pall Mall, with prospectuses, etc., with my compliments. We had a gorgeous 3 days with him in Berlin. Also, please set up a figure, an astrological chart, for him. And then he gives Huxley's birth date and place. So Crowley definitely asserts that he knew Huxley and met him, and one has to take anything Crowley writes or says, though, with a grain of salt, because he is known to exaggerate. He may have exaggerated a short meeting with Huxley into a three-day visit, or he may never have met him at all and was just trying to impress a hot young writer into helping Crowley at a time when his fortunes were going downhill. He had spent the fortune he inherited from his father's brewery at that point and had no money. So he definitely wanted a publisher. He wanted some help at that time. But I'm willing to say, yeah, they probably met and they knew each other. So I won't deny that.
It's almost like at that time, the first half of the 20th century, especially in the UK, that all roads led to Aleister Crowley.
Oh, a lot of them did. Crowley's a fascinating character.
That's another word for it.
he's a person that almost anything's been said about him, and it's really hard to separate the truth from the legend.
Yeah, it is.
And a lot of people have tried, and not having known him, I won't attempt to do that. I'd like to stay with the facts that I can determine. And I've always found Crowley fascinating. I'll have to tell you, I considered myself a Thelemite for a while,
okay.
And I sort of got over that. But in a way, as they say, if you get involved, it's hard to leave something totally behind like that. But I find a lot to admire in Crowley and his erudition, his intellectual capability to take very complex subjects and organize them. And I'll leave it at that.
All right.
Although his magical process, I think he gets a little too complicated with it. But anyways, that's.
But can you imagine?
It's just my opinion.
Well, as I alluded to before, that can you imagine being around wherever they were around at the same time when you got Yeats floating around with Joyce and Crowley?
Well, there were a lot of very interesting people in relatively small space.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. At that point. And they all tended to know each other. And I posted something on the Bloomsbury group on my blog, I think. I don't know if it's the first or second article down, just listing some of the members and their relationships to each other with some quotes by them. And try to sort that out. It's hard. You know, who was sleeping with who loved who, and it must have been especially scandalous back then.
Sure.
You know, maybe
sure.
Today it doesn't look so bad. You know, we see governors disappearing to Argentina, but.
What a jerk. Yeah, okay. Leave hiking crap in your SUV at the airport. That'll work. What a jerk.
Well, you know, I was in Argentina when I was in the Navy, and they do have some beautiful women down there, so.
Well, we don't doubt that, but I mean, it's like, dude, if you're going to have an affair, like. You might want to, like, go down a corner or something. God almighty. I mean,
yeah.
I know.
You know, hey, when you think with the wrong
second
way.
The brain.
Yeah.
Which is the more developed.
It's your classic midlife crisis. Jeez. Classic.
I'm just going down the corner to go to Argentina. All right. Don't cry for me. That's another whole thing.
I'm endlessly amused by that, though. I just cracked me up when I got home.
I know. The Bloomsbury group, though, I have to admit, too, I was thinking about this the last time you were on, because I think it was Virginia Woolf who wrote The Lighthouse. Do you remember The Lighthouse?
I did read that story, but it was a long time ago.
I know,
ago.
Me too, but I mean, it was excellent, too. That whole thing that I did in Brit Lit was like, okay, this is the empire fading, and we're really not, I mean, this is like the Soviet Union, too. No, nothing fades, it just reforms. And at the time when I was in that Brit Lit thing with this crew, you know, who wrote in the, well, and who were members of the Bloomsbury group, I'm like, and I did not think the way I did now back then, which would have been 95. But something was amiss. And I look back at it and I'm like, oh, now I understand it so perfectly. Because what most of these people wrote about, like Doris Lessing, who's a little bit later, obviously, and Virginia Woolf, The Lighthouse and all this, was just about something effete that was falling away and something new that had to, you know, come about. Actually, for a while there, not that anybody needs to know this, but after I read To The Lighthouse, I mean, I don't know, like at any given time when I was like in the rest, you know, the cafeteria, something like that, was like, To The Lighthouse. We're going. We're out of here. That's a strange.
But, you know, what you just said about, you know, things, nothing disappears, it fades, but it reforms, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what was going on there. You had Victorian era,
yes,
which saw, yep, as I mentioned, you know, reciting bits of Matthew Arnold's, Huxley's great uncle, his poem Dover Beach, how faith seemed to have disappeared from the world, mainly because of the discoveries of science. And mm-hmm, they couldn't, you know, they had this dialectic that either science is right or the spirit, the God, the Bible, or whatever is right. And neither, you know, and you have to choose one, and they reluctantly were choosing science, which made them abandon their faith. Now, Huxley seriously disagreed with that later on. I mean, he wrote an essay on it, how wrong that whole attitude was, that you had to pick one or the other. It's just, but anyway, we can maybe get into that later. But what happened was the Victorian age saw that whole faith, the whole devotion to God thing really disappear. And, you know, it's in effect to this day, but what happened was they had to reform on what their culture was going to be based on. They had to reform it, and I think in a way it may have been limited to the elites, to, you know, the intellectual structure, or how they were going to do it. They changed art. Art was changing totally after World War One. You know, the flower of England was dead, and it, you know, the people left behind maybe were a little more effete than the ones that would have been there if they had lived.
Okay,
it's just an idea. You know, maybe there would have been a more muscular literature if all those young men that died in the trenches hadn't died. But instead we got what we got, and we got a more ironic, a more, you know, a little bit of a raised eyebrow type of literature, a more abstract literature, a more difficult to understand literature, because they... I think a lot of them didn't want to come right out and say what they were thinking. They did reform the whole culture and at that point. And the Bloomsbury group, as I stated, their influence goes on to this day. I mean, John Maynard Keynes was a charter member, and his economic policies are in effect, and they're being used for good or bad. We'll see what happens right now by the United States government.
But let me ask you this, as it might pertain, and you might have to speculate, or maybe you won't. And however it is, I'm asking you this cold. I look at the poets from the Lost Generation, the writers of the Lost Generation, those that came in after World War One, and I think also this Bloomsbury group was impacted by this, and writers and poets will go where they will. Whether they wanted to look at the world as nothing but more nihilism, or if something would spring, you know, from the hopes of humanity to change things, and I won't categorize which writers might have been in which, but certainly what came out of that era, as I had said to you, you know, we have T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, and we have works by Yeats and Virginia Woolf and such. How does,
and they're all great works. I mean,
oh,
I'm not
they
saying
are.
They're bad.
Yes.
I mean, they're The Wasteland. You can go into that poem and you know, come out changed. It's great poetry.
You know,
but it's not what may have happened if, you know, there wasn't a World War One.
John, no doubt, and I'll tell you, I'm not much for free verse and all that stuff. I, there's another reason for that, but I don't think anybody could ever do The Wasteland again. I mean, that was T.S. Eliot. That was a one-time deal. Don't try to do it again.
American.
Would you agree?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, that's the thing about, you know, absolutely great works of art is they're unique and original. And The Wasteland, it is. It really is.
But, I mean, and others also. I mean, Auden was in at that time. But, again, Huxley being aware of all this, too. I never thought about Huxley, and it was never brought up in the Brit Lit class, if you will, in that, you know, Norton anthology that I have, where he fit in. He was conspicuously absent, and perhaps maybe for a good reason. I don't know. But if you were to insert him in the Norton anthology, why would you do it, and how would you do it?
Well, if I would put, definitely, if I were to insert Huxley into one of the compendiums of literature that you get in a typical college course, it would be his essays. I don't think he was a compelling fiction writer. I think there are some things in his fiction that are well worth finding. I find 1984 a much better written book than Brave New World. But Huxley's essays are wonderful. I mean, his knowledge, his essays on art, as an artist, his essays on art I find very enlightening. And that's where I would put him, as a supreme intellectual and essayist. He was not an atheist.
Okay.
He wasn't an atheist in the sense of totally, you know, he was in the sense of maybe the Buddha sense of atheism, which is really a little different, maybe, in the sense that there's no Godhead, but it's all God, everything.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm rustling around here, and excuse me if I'm being rude, because I ran for my British anthology and such, and Huxley's not in there. And that's not a big deal, I don't think. But I will tell you something, if you don't mind, it's a little digression.
Digress.
Well, thank you. John, I mean, have you ever heard us talk about the city of London being different than London?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a different. Yeah, that's where the bank is, and
that's where the Rothschilds hold.
The Rothschilds, and yes.
But I have to laugh because on the back flap of the Norton Anthology, English Literature, sixth edition, volume 2, the back flap has a map of London, and within that map, they have a little proscribed area here that's called the city.
Voila.
Which meant nothing to me in 1995.
And now, but now you know.
And now I know.
Now you know the rest of the story.
All right, now, one other thing, too, and I think this is exactly where Huxley, maybe deservedly so, takes the brickbats. And that is the idea that, you know what, and you'll understand when I say this, posting, and the books just all fell off the table there, as you could hear. But deservedly so, perhaps, his idea was, you know, let the hillbillies do what they have to do and just give them whatever pleasures they may need to get them by. Do you see, I mean,
that's what he presented in Brave New World, but he had a lot of compassion for people. His if you read his essays, there's one essay where he's very concerned about people dying for lack of food, and he says there's no reason why the world can't feed everybody. You know, he doesn't sound like one of these people who is enjoying famine and watching people die and watching the population of the world be cut to some manageable level. He sounds like someone that is criticizing science for not helping third world countries take care of themselves and instead setting up a system. He specifically says he doesn't like the centralized system where they're beholden to first world entities for their existence. They can never catch up. He specifically says that in a couple of his essays. He says that not only should these countries be given food so that they aren't on the brink of starvation and have no human energy to do anything but just try to survive. He felt they should have enough time so that they can do other things, they can use their creative abilities to discover things, build their own culture besides just scraping by. He also said that they should be given the ability to take care of themselves, that they can grow their own food.
Yeah, great point.
He specifically said that he felt that this world system that pretends to help third world countries by handouts, because it's the old story, give a man a fishing pole and teach him to fish, that's
right.
Exactly where Huxley was. And to me, that doesn't sound like an elitist.
Well, obviously...
I mean, he was an elitist in the sense of
yeah.
an intellectual elitist. But he... You know, I don't think he's just a cold intellect that had no feelings or compassion. And of course, compassion is kind of a loaded word, but...
Well, two things. I'm going to ask you, and this will be the springboard for part three, and that was whether we had a change in the heart of Huxley. But let's leave that for that time. Now, what I'm going to say to you is this. Some would think that what he saw... And you accurately stated it. I mean, if he had some umbrage toward what was not going on in third world countries, which we all can appreciate now, if he truly felt that compassionately, well, then, you know, he hit something on the core, because I think you would have to admit, and I'm going to ask you to speak to this, John, you know, not only with the research you've done with Huxley, but obviously in the experience of your life, and that is, why are underdeveloped countries still underdeveloped at this stage in the game? And if they are they left to do that, to basically swing in the breeze for a further, what would you call it, oppression or occupation?
Well, it's global. It's the global system, Keith. But, you know,
yes,
I agree. The book, I think, it spells it out pretty well. Although it may be a little embellished. Is the book Confessions of a Corporate Hitman. I can't remember who wrote it.
Right.
But
right.
It's a pretty good book. I read it a few years ago, and I felt maybe he was exaggerating here and there, or maybe he was, you know, trying to make it a little more of a
commercial story.
Yeah. Not commercial, but more of a story.
Okay.
You know, I think he was almost looking for a movie script out of it, but it's a good book, and, you know, maybe, you know, it may be disinformation, too. Who knows? You know, I think once you're in, you're never out. So.
Yeah, but the point being is that...
But basically spells out they want to keep these countries dependent.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want them to get out from under the system. They don't want them to ever pay off their debts. They don't want them to develop their own economy to make them independent countries. And they want them to import all the crap and
mm-hmm.
as much as possible and be in debt to them. And... Which is evil, really. It's evil. There's no two ways about it.
Well, yeah, no doubt. And that's why we look at things. We look at technology. We look at the possibilities. And somehow, some way, in certain geographic reasons, the possibilities of technology are suspended, much as the laws of physics were suspended in certain places on September 11th, 2001. But that's for another thing.
True.
But again,
true.
With Huxley... you know, when I heard his talk, as I told you, the last speech I believe he gave.
The Berkeley speech.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the last, yes.
What was it, The Ultimate Revolution? I don't know where he was. I mean, like Orwell, Huxley had phases of his life too. Maybe everyone who does. But those who are involved with literature and getting their ideas out, it becomes a bit more magnified. But at that time, when I listened to it, you know, I understood the validity of it, but I got that little feeling of like, well, you son of a bitch. It's like, you know, all of us are Morlocks, and just take the Soma and you'll be okay. I know it's a mixed metaphor. But now, the larger question, and what I want to end this interview on, is whether or not, like we know Orwell went through, did Huxley go through a number of phases, the last of which would have begotten that Berkeley speech, what do we look at the individual with regard to compassion, true compassion for everyone?
Well, I think where we're going is the last phase of Huxley's life was the drug guru phase. He became one of the prime spokespersons for consciousness-altering drugs. He felt they were benign. He felt that they would free people from the
drudgery,
the tunnel vision that most of us go through life, where we never even attempt to look through the veil. Where he felt that drugs allowed people to see reality, or see a kind of reality beyond the cultural norms that are put on us. You know, we're all brought up to believe this, believe that. Culture gives us we have a language, a shared language. And as an anthropologist, it's not just us. It's every society that's ever been in the world does this. They prepare people to function in society. And that's important. You need language. It's brought us out of the savannas, and it's brought us to build cities, and it's brought us to create writing and the literature and the cultural memory.
But it also
limits us to itself. And there always have to be a few pioneers that are willing to look beyond the culture to something else. And it's not hard to do because those people often get burned at the stake. They often get jailed or executed. And that's basically what Huxley was most interested in at the end of his life. He felt that children should be educated in nonverbal thinking. It was something he was very interested in thinking outside cultural norms, to have practice in it. So we could have people that were able to adapt more quickly to change, and to not be limited by just the stuff that we're supposed to do, you know, limited just by our jobs, just by the entertainment we're provided. And he felt human beings could do much, much more. He felt that we had limitless abilities. I kind of agree with that.
Yeah.
But anyways, we can get into that next time.
Well, I tried to Alex,
because it's a fascinating story, the whole era.
I've been trying to Alex Jones you till the last minute, and it didn't work out. And I applaud you for like going on and just stepping all over me because I was trying to step on you. Honestly, and we're not done with this, and I appreciate the fact that you'll come back again. And that is, the whole idea of education and trying to make students, okay, critically analyze stuff, I don't know that's happening. If Huxley wanted that, if he wanted to, as we would say, and I think you're somewhat familiar with this, John, and the taxonomy of education that was Bloom's, to create, and that's great to create, but you need a foundation. My point is, like I said, I'm going to leave this, and we're going to go into the third show, along with the fact whether there was a hidden Huxley, and that is whether or not Huxley might have broken with the University of Chicago neophytes like Dewey and Bloom, who wanted to train rather than teach. And although I understand that Huxley was saying, yes, there's an element there where you can create and critically analyze, I don't know that really happened. So I'm going to give you a last shot. I know this is a bit enigmatic, what I've just said. But what Huxley said on face sounds good. What I think was put in practice after the fact did not work out so well. So do you want to give us a last salvo on that?
Well, what I'd like to do to finish it up is another thing I said last time was I'm really not prepared to answer what you just said.
No, I know. It's an ad hoc question.
So, but what I did say that I mentioned that Huxley's essay on drugs, The Doors of Perception, that Jim Morrison took the name to get the name of his band. And I have a little anecdote about Jim Morrison.
Do it.
When I met him. Well, I can do it next time. We'll tease. It's a tease.
All right.
Okay?
Oh, you're bad. But you're
That's
learning.
The tease. That's the classic radio thing. Come on. Anyways.
Come back next week, yes.
No, I do have a personal meeting with Jim Morrison story. Anyways, I would like to end with, of course, doors of perception is a phrase that came from William Blake.
Right.
And Huxley entitled his essay, Doors of Perception. And Plate 14 in his Blake's poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, has these words in it, which is will take about a minute to say.
That's
and
okay.
It has the phrase Doors of Perception in it. I think it's very interesting.
Go.
Here we go.
Yep.
The ancient tradition that the world will be consumed in fire at the end of 6,000 years is true, as I have heard from hell. For the cherub with his flaming sword is hereby commanded to leave his guard at the tree of life. And when he does, the whole creation will be consumed and appear infinite and holy, whereas it now appears finite and corrupt. This will come to pass by an improvement of sensual enjoyment. But first, the notion that man has a body distinct from his soul is to be expunged. This I shall do by printing in the infernal method, by corrosives, which in hell are salutary and medicinal, melting apparent surfaces away and displaying the infinite which was hid. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees things, till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. And that exactly has to do with what we were just talking about.
All right.
William Blake.
Yeah, I remember him well, not fondly, but he's not one of my favorites, but okay. And I'll tell you what, we'll go to round three, and we'll springboard off of what we did today. And again, folks, if you want to chime in on this, and again, John, I think you don't have a problem with somebody just emailing you or going.
You can email me, johnnyb93@gmail.com, or a comment on my blog.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, we really don't know, and we're not far. We're not really done with this whole situation. So, it's really interesting, and I think
I am open-minded on this. My ideas aren't carved in stone on this. I'm willing to listen to anybody.
But you know, okay, last question. Not a big deal, but I think, I don't believe in political parties and all that other crap, but I think we're seeing a lot of what might have already taken place in Europe with regard to socialization happening right now here through many of the ways that
I think it's more like national socialization.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. Yep. Okay, good point. I'm not going to, you're right. And so we're seeing that happen now, so I think it's very pertinent to what's going on in the public view, although they're not really getting the whole idea. They're still lost in that dichotomy between Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah. I don't think people will wake up until it really starts hitting home.
Yeah, until the time
hitting
the
pocketbook, out. They're still propping up the system desperately.
Giving everybody something to believe in, and they haven't gotten the idea that they've been already cut loose. But be that as it may, John Bonanno has been with us, and we've been talking about Huxley, misunderstood, maybe not misunderstood, maybe somebody who changed horses in midstream, which might be the case, and also his relation, more contrapositioned, with George Orwell.
Rising up angry in the sky, and there's a new voice crying for not afraid to die. Let the old world make believe it's blind and left bad run, but nothing can change the shame of things to come. There are changes lying ahead in every road. There are new thoughts ready and waiting to explode. When tomorrow is today, the bells may toll for some, but nothing can change the shape of things to come.
This program is produced by Visigoth Incorporated. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without the express consent of Visigoth Incorporated is strictly encouraged. I'm Phil McCracken, the voice behind the voice, and thank you for listening.